So for those of you who are not aware, I just want to make sure that everybody knows of the two wonderful books that Aziz has published or has authored. One is called Crossing Boundaries, and he'll speak more about that in a little bit. And the other is Strangers, Neighbors, and Friends, written actually by three contributors, one Christian, one Muslim, and one Jewish. And there was a quote here that actually, Aziz, I wanted to ask you about, and Moz, you're welcome to respond as well. In one of your chapters, you quoted Stephen Hawking. And Stephen Hawking was asked, what is the biggest threat to humanity? And you commented that, you know, you would have thought that he might say something like an asteroid hitting the Earth or the destruction of our environment. And yet he answered, the biggest threat to humanity is human aggression, which may have had advantages in the days of cavemen, but now it threatens to destroy us all. And Hawking wanted to focus on empathy to safeguard our future. And you spoke about travel. And you said that travel is an effective avenue for promoting peace and understanding. And of course, you founded Mejdi Tours. And Maoz, of course, travel has been such an important part of your path toward peace and understanding. And you said that we don't live on isolated islands. We are all connected. Can you speak a little bit more about Mejdi Tours? First of all, what does it mean? And what do you think that we can do, especially given the environment that we're living here in the United States right now and the conflicts that we're experiencing in Israel and Gaza, Iran? How can we actually create more empathy amongst each other?
All right. I'm going to stand because of the screen so I can see everyone. I love the question, and when I read, like you said, when I read that quote by Stephen Hawking, I was like, oh, I wonder where he's going to go with that. And it was just before he passed away, and when he said aggression is the greatest threat, it does make sense. As we look around the world, aggression, division, those are the things that make sense. And before starting Mejdi, I worked in conflict resolution other parts around the world. I worked in Afghanistan for a few years, on and off, going back and forth. I worked in Syria quite a lot. I worked on Iran quite a lot. And what Scott and I felt is that we wanted to do something that reaches people who might not come to a peace meeting, who might not come to this gathering. And so we started looking at different industries, and we felt travel is just an incredible industry because people are much more open to being challenged when they travel than any other time. They're willing to go out of their comfort zone more than any other time. They'll visit a cultural thing, they'll see a museum, they'll meet people, they'll read things that they wouldn't have read otherwise. And so we decided to go co-found Mejdi to go into tourism. And we called it Mejdi because the Arabic word Mejdi means honor and glory, and that the branding for it is to honor and glorify the place where we're visiting, the people where we're going, and the travelers themselves, and to think of those three elements in every trip we run, which also means not everyone's going to travel with us because not everyone sees travel in this way, and that is fine. There's no company can meet the demand of everyone. There's now 1.4 billion people who travel internationally this year. So there's enough people who are traveling. And what we wanted to do is to create a company that becomes a vehicle for peacemaking. Give access to narratives you don't hear. There's another quote I use a lot. It's my favorite quote probably of all time. It says, travel makes you speechless, but then it turns you into a storyteller. It's by Ibn Battuta, who's my hero, the first famous Arab traveler out of Tangier who went, you know, all over the known world at the time, about 700-800 years ago. And that is very true. And I always ask people, you travel a lot, do you come back with a story to tell? And what type of story do you come back with? That's how we build empathy. It's through stories. I think nothing connects human beings better than stories. And when we listen to someone's story, if I just sit here and start giving you facts about horrible things happening around the world, you won't respond. You'll feel bad. That's not going to touch your heart. But the moment we tell each other a story, something that we can identify with, empathize with, understand, connect with, that's eventually how we can build a better world and we can have more of that empathy we're talking about. But to do it, you have to get out of your comfort zone and talk to people who you don't listen to their stories usually. And so ask yourself, what's the missing story in my community? Now, we talk about travel. I remember going to Vietnam first time, and it's one of my top. If people ask me what's your favorite places around the world, Vietnam is ranks very high. And before going there, I started thinking about, oh, I want to go to Vietnam, I want to connect to the culture. And then I realized I lived at the time in one of the places that had the highest concentration of Vietnamese in America. And I didn't have a one Vietnamese friend. I never went to any Vietnamese restaurant. I never went to a culture center. I didn't go to any event. I'm like, this is kind of absurd. So I'm like all about, I want to connect to Vietnamese culture by going to Vietnam. But if I really wanted to connect to Vietnamese culture, the first step was to meet the Vietnamese community in my own neighborhood. And I think that's one thing we could all do, is to start connecting to people in our own communities, instead of just thinking, how far can I go? Sure, travel, but if you don't do it in your own community, you're not going to do it also when you go far away, in my opinion. So since you mentioned the books, I have a gift for both of you. And this is one for you. And Danielle, this is one for you. And I signed them.
To Chaim. Keep crossing more boundaries, Aziz. And to Danielle as well. Thank you, Aziz.
And then can we just note that they together are co-writing a book that you can pre-order.
Yes.
And it's called?
The Future is Peace. Woo!
And the publication date, I think, is next February.
It's coming up. The coming February. I want to add one more thing, and think Maoz, you can add to that, is travel. What we realize, we cannot reach enough people through travel. And so you have to think beyond also travel. Not enough people, sadly, from a business perspective, going to travel with Mejdi Tours. And not enough people were going to stay at the Abraham Guest House. So we have to create a place where people can come to. And so where Maoz started Fawzi Azhar, we are turning that place into a dual narrative center. And what we thought about in Israel, in Palestine, there's not a one place you can go to where you can learn about those different perspectives, different mindsets, different point of views, different narratives that exist, different Jewish narratives, different Palestinian narratives, because the reality, dual narrative, is a bit misleading. It's a nice title, but every narrative has many narratives. And so we are creating that place in Nazareth where everyone can come and get to learn about those different narratives, and it will bring the stories alive. We're bringing speakers, voices, videos, interactive things, an employment center, so many things that will exist in that center. So, and our hope is it will be for both locals and travelers that can come and spend half a day, a full day, come back many times, have interfaith meetings, have conflict resolution meetings, dialogue, food, exploring. When we talk about narratives, it's not only political, it's cultural. There are so many elements of different narratives that we don't even think about when we talk about different narratives. Like one of my favorite tours I've done in Jerusalem used to be East and West Jerusalem food. and just going to Mahne Yehuda market and going to the Old City in Jerusalem market and explore the narratives around food. And so the narratives around music, the narratives around culture, the narratives around art, the narratives around so many different things. And so there's so much we can do, and we're both excited to do that. This is one of Interact main projects that we are working on.
Thank you. And I will, so Aziz said it all about how we're going to transform the Fawzi Azhar into a dual narrative education center. I would also would like to comment about Hawking's world. And again, we were privileged to meet really faith leaders like Pope Francis and many other scholars and faith leaders and spiritual leaders. And a war is a disease we are bringing upon ourselves. We create wars. It's not a comet that is coming from the sky. It's not a volcano that's erupting. It's not a tsunami that's coming from the ocean. We make it for ourselves. Human create wars, and human end wars. So if the war has already been waged, it means that we already failed. As human, we are all accountable for what we are doing for ourselves. So when war is being waged, we are already failed. And we need to prevent wars. It's like prevent medicine. It's cheaper, and then it's our life are much better. So we need to start investing in preventing wars and not to get ready for it. Because when you are getting ready for something, it happens. Mm-hmm. So many people also ask me, Moses, what should we do now? Prepare for peace. What does it mean if peace happens now? Now, before the night, tonight. How can we be prepared for peace? And we need to change our mindset and start preparing for a lasting and global peace, and then it will come.
So, Ma'oz, I'll direct this question to you. It's very easy. Back in 2005, when you reached out to the Fawzi Azhar family in Nazareth, you came to them with a crazy idea. Mm-hmm. What was their first response to that idea, and how long did it take to continue to sort of build some trust? I think what happens for many of us is we look at peace building, or we look at even a relationship between a synagogue and a church, and people from the outside look in and go, oh, look at that. That's lovely. I want to do that. But I know from our point of view, where we are today has taken 13 years. And previous to that, it took 5+ years of just Rabbi Ari, Emeritus Rabbi here at Etzim, and I just becoming friends and trusting one another so that he could get to the point of offering the space. Mm-hmm. How long, can you tell us a little bit about the Fawzi Azhar story and then how you shared life together?
Okay. Thanks for the easy question. So in 2024, we hiked the Israel National Trail, Shlomit, my partner and I, and then traveled here in California and South America. And in South America, we visited an indigenous community in the Andes of Ecuador. We stayed a week with the community. And we saw firsthand how tourism can empower local community, helping them preserve their heritage, their culture, their lifestyle, and at the same time making money. So we said this is exactly what we want to do in Israel, and we also were shocked how much we know about indigenous people in South America, but we don't know 50% of the people living between the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. We didn't know anything about 20% of the Palestinian cities of Israel. We didn't know the difference between Eid al-Adha, Eid al-Fitr, and Ramadan. We didn't know where Jesus was born, where he's buried, and never, never heard about the Annunciation. We were living within ignorance. Walls of ignorance, mental and physical walls, and we decided to use tourism in order to open a gate in this ignorance. So we decided to open a guest house in Nazareth, the largest Palestinian city within Israel. And we fell in love with the city from first sight, and the first step we took in the city in January 2005, and we explored the city for a full day, and then we wanted to stay overnight. But there was not even one single hotel, guest house, family stay, a room, or even a dorm bed. You could not find any accommodation facility within the old city. So we said, okay, we'll open the first one. So we explored the city even more, and then we found out really an amazing, amazing building from the Ottoman time owned by a local family. So I give them a call, and then the lady, Odette Azar, she's asking me, I'm telling her, look, I'm in the courtyard of your house. It's totally run down. It's open for everyone. The windows are broken. One roof collapsed, literally collapsed. And it's a beautiful building, and I want to open a hostel here in your building. And on the phone, you're Jewish, right? Yes. You Jewish people, you took all our land in the Nakba back in 48. Is there no shame in you? Now you want to take my parents' house? So I told her, look, I wasn't born back then, and I'm from the south, so it's not me. And now I want to bring life back to your own property, but to the entire city that basically collapsed after facing many challenges, mostly the second intifada and the October riots. So I told her, I want to bring life. So would you just meet me for coffee? So I had a very, very, she approved, and we had a very, very long coffee meeting. And then the time after, we had lunch. And then she showed me the house from the inside. So I fell in love even more in the house. First meeting, she took me like around to introduce me to the shopkeepers. The very few that were still open. And then the fifth meeting, only 5 months after coming back from a world backpacking, a year backpacking around the world, she told me, Maoz, are you serious? Do you really want to open a guest house in what we call cemetery? It's no one's land. No one is going there. It's so dangerous. There is crime and drug dealers. And above all, they will do something for you just because you are a Jew. So I tell her, I'm not afraid. And this is exactly what I want to do. So she taking a set of keys from her pocket, and she tells me, I have three, you can start your project, and I have three conditions. First, you must name it after my father, Fawzi Azar, because we are only daughters, so no one is continuing the family name. Second, you keep it a Palestinian house. I don't want to have Israel independence celebration, no Magen David, or mezuzah, or Hanukkah. You keep it Palestinian tradition. And then also, you explain me in our 5 meetings, I get it that you have no money. You are totally broke. I got it. I'm still totally broke. The QR code will be soon, but now it's going to interact, not to me. And so, here we go. Thank you, Aziz. That's a good partner. Good brother. So she tell me, okay, I understand you cannot invest any money, but you guarantee that in the next 5 years you're going to invest equivalent to, like in US dollar, I'm trying to do it, like 2,500 US dollar a month, but instead of paying rent, you will renovate. So in total, something like 60,000-70,000 US dollar in 5 years. And then she is giving me the keys. And it was the most scaring 10 seconds I ever had in my life. Like, am I actually going to fulfill my dream or not? And of course, I'm taking the keys and I'm calling Shlomit. I'm telling her, honey, we got the keys. I'm staying overnight alone in this beautiful but round down palace in the old city of Nazareth. And it took us 4 days to open. 4 days after, we opened the Fawzi Azar Inn. Only with 3 rooms, basic renovation, cleaning, start getting furniture and stuff from the market, and we opened. And what we proved in Nazareth is that the lowers the wall are, the higher the security. I will say it again. The lower the wall, higher the security. 80% of the Palestinian residents of Nazareth nowadays are first, second, or third generation of the Nakba, of the war in 40. Refugees. Thanks. 80% are refugees. First, second, or third generation refugees. 80% of the residents in Gaza nowadays, 80%, exactly like in Nazareth, are first, second, or third generation of refugees from 48. And in Nazareth, you can walk. You were there, Daniel. Many of you are here. Noah, every time Noah is coming to Israel, we meet in Nazareth. If you're Jewish, if you're a Christian, if you're Muslim, if whatever, you can walk freely and safely in the old city of Nazareth. Because when there is a dialogue, when you look into each other in the eye, when we embrace the conflict, okay, and not oppress it, not silence it, but walking within the conflict, then we are able to evolve and create something new. And exactly like you here together and your communities, you created something new. We were able to do exactly the same in Nazareth. And to prove it, one day a guest is coming to me and telling me that he can't find his laptop.
No, you missed something.
I missed something, yes?
That you have decided to not lock the place, so they know why it happened.
Okay. We didn't lock the place. The front door was always open. Everyone could come in and out. And the guest, like Daniel, you got a key to your room. But the place in itself was open for everyone, including the drug dealers, including the youth, but also the respectable people from the community. Everyone could come in. So one morning, a guest is telling me that the laptop is missing. So in my morning round, I had a morning round meeting like dozens of people every morning from the community. I told everyone, one of the guests is missing his laptop. Before the day end, the laptop was already back. Because it was within the interest of the community that the guest will feel safe and secure. So this is how, when everyone's interest is that the others will also be safe and secure, that's how you can create security and safety. And there are some Israelis here in the audience, there are more Jewish here in the audience. The only thing that Israelis care about is security and safety. We care about nothing else. But nowhere in history, no place, no conflict, security was being able to achieved by military force. Never you can achieve security and safety through dialogue, through negotiation, through diplomacy. If you act only with force, you're never going to achieve it. It never worked. It's not working nowadays, and it will never work in the future.
Thank you, Moses. So one of the questions that rose to the top is, how do you respond to friends and family that view Israelis as the only victims and deny victimization of Palestinians?
Can you read that again?
How do you respond to friends and family that view Israelis as the only victims and deny victimization of Palestinians?
First, Aziz and I, we never argue with no one. Okay? And to be a victim is also a choice. We can all choose what we want to be. We can choose to be a victim. We can choose to be an oppressor. By choosing to be a victim, you are just ensuring you will stay a victim for your whole life. And you will give it also to the next generation. So, yes, even though I lost my parents, I've chosen not to be a victim anymore. I'm not willing to be a victim. So every one of us can choose what he wants to be. So, but I cannot choose for the others. If someone chooses to be a victim, it's his. Okay, I cannot convince him, or I definitely not going to argue with him, but I can model him a different path. I can model him the path to freedom. And as long as you choose to be a victim, you're never going to be free. So every one of us need to ask himself, do I want to be free or not? So I choose to be free. But every one of us can take the same choice, the same decision, and have the opportunity and the potential to be free. But it's also when we put victimhood behind us. So probably that's what I will answer.
Yeah, thank you.
So, like
so many people are asking, what is the plan that you mentioned earlier?
They don't know it. So I will highlight the five chapters of the plan, and then maybe Aziz, you can go in details. Also, we try because we live in such a complexity situation and complex world. We try to simplify everything. Okay, and also because we are guys and we are not that advanced, so if it's got more than five something, we don't know it. So the plan has
five. We often forget one.
Yeah. So the plan has five chapters. Very simple. Chapter number one is to dream. It's going back to the core. And what we learned is that the only way to change reality is through dreaming. Only dreams can change our reality. And we decided to position ourselves in the field of dream, which is the most important field for humanity. And unfortunately, for too long, we left this field for the extremists. And their dream is our nightmare and our reality. And the only way to overcome is that we'll position ourselves in this field. And all prophets, Jewish, Muslim, and Christian, all prophets, their prophecy is about the same dream: justice, equality, and reconciliation. This is the dreams our ancient prophets gave to us, and this is our legacy. So we must go back to this field and start dreaming. The second chapter is exactly what we are doing now, to amplify our dream. We must be proud. Yes, we have a dream and we are proud of it. So we are sharing it with you. We already shared it this morning. We are sharing it in our books, on our flyers, in our coming books, TED Talk, every stage. But it's not only us. It's our coalition. Okay, we formed a coalition that is sharing the dream. This is why early May, we have done the People Peace Summit in Jerusalem. More than 8,000 participants, Palestinian and Israelis, that together for 2 days, we were shouting, dancing and crying, peace. So this is how you amplify your dream. The third is to legitimize peace. We must legitimize peace, because now what is the only thing that is legitimized is war and tools of destruction and weapon. But that will never bring us not to security, not to safety, not to justice, and not to peace. So we must legitimize peace and legitimize us as the leaders of the future. So meeting Pope Francis, meeting policymakers, meeting faith leaders, this is how we can legitimize ourselves. The fourth is policy change. I think Aziz already talked about before. Policy change to advocate changing the investment from tool of distractions to tools of construction. So we are doing it in various venues. And the fifth is to create the political will to sign the peace treaty. And I'm saying political will because I don't care, and Ophir is here. Ophir, where is Ophir? Ophir is gone? He's missing the most important thing. I waited just for him to hear it. I don't care who's going to sign the peace treaty. I don't care. I already forgived everyone. Usually, or many times, those who sign the peace treaty have blood on their hands. And we need to help them be transformed. Okay? Not to go against them, but tell them, if you will be transformed and change your way and choose the path to peace, then we will support you. So it's not going against them. I'm not going against anyone. Because everyone has the potential to be transformed and for redemption. So we need to show them this way. So it's creating the political will. So those like dream, amplifying, legitimize, change the policies, and political will. Thanks.
There is a...
Sorry? please. Thank you.
There is a saying by Kafka that goes, by believing passionately in something that still does not exist, we create it. The non-existent is whatever we have not sufficiently desired. So
that's for Kafka.
That's, yeah. So I think that's exactly what we are doing, is creating a new reality. I think when we think of extremist groups and we think of people we don't support their policies, who they are, what they're doing, so on, in Israel and Palestine, this is exactly what they've done. I think when people go, oh, but you're not anymore the majority. I don't know if we are or not, but let's assume that's true. We're not the majority. But neither were the people or are the people who are promoting death and destruction. You know, when I look at the settler groups, when I look at how Hamas grew, they weren't a majority. And yet, they did exactly what Kafka did. You know, the sad part about this quote, it works both ways. It works if you're a radical, works if you're a peacemaker. And so there is something to learn about. You have to create facts on the ground. You have to model an alternative. You have to show what's different. And that's why I think people who are, and the extreme ends, see us as a threat. They see us as their greatest threat. Peacemakers are, that's why you see policies trying to stop us from doing stuff together. Things like stopping the parent circle from going into schools. That's not done for no reason. It's not a political ploy only. It's because they know that works. When you walk into a school, Maoz and I have done it recently in Israel and Palestine. When you walk into a school and they see us, that's a threat to them because we show that what they say is impossible is actually possible. That peace is actually something that we could do. So that's one. So one of the things we've been doing is not only for Israelis and Palestinians, but also outside Israel and Palestine, we want people to see that this is possible. So we created a program, we call it Peace Talks, and we're trying to bring as many voices of Palestinians, of Israelis possible, and promote them to come and speak to, because Maoz and I cannot do all the invitations we get, which is nice, we're getting all of them, but we can't be everywhere. And so Maoz's family, brother and sisters are part of it. People like Yonatan Zagan, whose mother, Vivian Silver, was killed on October 7th. People like Amira Muhammad, who is an incredible, I would say one of the most eloquent Palestinian young women and peacemaker, and many others. And so trying to promote those as speakers everywhere. Trying to promote also them to be able to fund their own work, because today most funding to peace work is gone. Thanks to the current administration, they cut all funding to peace work and they increased funding to war. Yay. Because that worked very well so far. So that's one of those things we've been doing as part of this plan. The other thing we are doing is creating symbolic and powerful examples of how our work together makes a difference. And we need people to see us doing that. It is very important to create those kind of events. The It's Time Coalition, the People's Summit that Maoz talked about, but we also in September 21st, anybody knows why September 21st? Peace Day, yay! We are doing a march, two marches, one from East Jerusalem and one from West Jerusalem together, meeting in the middle, again, symbolic way of us meeting, and then getting together, marching together after to a spot where we can all gather and talk. And our messages are hardcore messages too. We will say we don't believe in occupation, we don't believe in war, we don't believe in injustice, we don't believe in equality, but we also will talk about the future we believe in. You can't only march for what you're against, you have to talk about what you're standing for. And too often we talk about what we're against, but we don't talk about what we're standing for. And people have to hear that. We're standing for a future where the two of us can be equal, can live side by side. So that's another example of something that we are doing that fits into changing the paradigm and bringing people to support changing the political will underground. The meetings we talked about, whether it's with Pope Francis or Pope Leo or with members of Congress or with mayors all over the world or with government foreign policy. I just met with Attorney General in the UK right before he announced with Maoz's brother, before they announced sanctioning Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. We were... McGinn and I in Switzerland, and then later on Amira and McGinn in Switzerland advocating for not cutting aid to Palestinians in Gaza, which is unfortunately many European governments have done in the times when we desperately need that aid. So there are things that we are doing on very high level, and that is changing policies that we are talking about. And then with amplifying voices, I think we just keep telling people we need you to share this message. We terribly need you. When you go online and you're putting posts online, don't only post about the terrible things that happen. I understand, and I do it too, because we need people to be aware of what's going on, but also give people a message of what can be. And so remember to amplify the voices of peacemakers and legitimize those voices. Share that. Try to push your media outlets. I mean, I watch... Sadly, I do watch too much TV sometimes. And peacemakers, once a month, you might get one voice. And I can tell you, the most articulate people in Israel and Palestine are the peacemakers. And it's not that we only hug and kiss and talk about peace, but we can analyze even political stuff. But we never get, in, like, we'll get once a month here and there invited. That's not enough. That needs to change. And American media is the worst. I've been to Europe, I've been to Asia, I've been to Africa. American media is by far the worst in inviting peacemakers. And when they invite us, it's like as short as possible and not relevant to anything often. So that can change by you pushing those media outlets, sending messages to them, sending letters to them, telling your friends, these are the people we want you to interview. So there's a lot we have to do together.
Thank you. Thank you, yes. I think we have one question that says, what's your opinion of the phrase, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free? Is it helpful or unhelpful? That's the question. I didn't write it.
We never talked about it. No. Let's see what we think.
First, I would say that we can debate and argue about words for hours, maybe days. Sometimes we're going to win the argument and debate. Sometimes we're going to lose. But arguing is, I'm saying, it's broadening the gap, okay? And the division between us. It's just polarizing us. So for me, it doesn't really matter if what's happening now in Gaza, okay? Is if we call it a war, justified war, genocide, ethnical cleansing. It doesn't matter how we call it, we must stop it. What's happening now in Gaza must be stopped. And then after we stop it, we can start talking about it. And I'm not also being intimidated by protesters that do say, from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. But I would say that when we choose one side, and from this statement you can think that they choose the Palestinian side, we ensure the conflict will continue. Because like someone will shout that, someone will shout something exactly the opposite. And we're ensuring the conflict will continue. But it's great that they care. It's really great that people do care. So far away from our homeland, people care about us. Or about them. They do care. They literally, authentically care. So that's amazing. But they are just ensuring the conflict will continue. And the division and polarization will just get worse and worse. So if you want to end the conflict, support the peacemakers. Support equality. Support dignity. Support acknowledgement. Support us. Support the peace movement. And then we'll be able to achieve a lasting peace in the Middle East. Because what's happening nowadays also, and you know it much better than me, I'm just hearing it from you, that you are importing the conflict here to your communities, universities, cities, and politicians. And the side you choose, or your neighbor choose, becoming part of his own identity. People throughout the globe identify themselves by which side they choose. So we are here to beg, to cry, to offer, and to call for your support and partnership to solve the conflict, the century-long conflict in our region between the river to the sea. And we're going to achieve it by 2030. And then you will be able to import the solution. And you know much better than I do that you need a solution here in your community too. So when we'll make peace in the Holy Land, the symbol of it, the symbol of peace in the Holy Land is going to be so great and so empowering all so many other communities. So let's focus now in peace between the river to the sea, and then everyone in the world will be free.
Let me mess it up. I think there are two, three thoughts that come to my mind, and they partially answer that question, partially maybe in the bigger aspect. I think you normally want to say things that will resonate with people. The moment it doesn't work, the moment people assign to it a different meaning, then you want to think, how effective is what am I saying? And there's a difference between what I want to say. Like, when I hear it, I don't hear something pro-Palestinian or hateful. Palestinians being free is not anti-Israel, it's not anti-Jewish. I think that's, to me, it doesn't do that. Now, if that's how people hearing it, then I have to think, what do I say that people hear what I'm trying to say? So there's that one element. But there's one reason I actually don't like this saying. And partially, the first time the concept from the river to the sea is mentioned is in the Likud charter. From the river to the sea, all land will be sovereign by Israel. And I don't like taking anything from the Likud charter. And it's not my favorite document. So that's another part why I don't like the terminologies in general. But I do want to say we have to be careful of one thing. Nonviolent work is provocative. And I keep hearing too often of people saying, oh, Palestinians did this as a nonviolent action, but it's too provocative. That's what nonviolence is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a little provocative. It's supposed to push you out of your comfort zone. It's supposed to make you, it's symbolic. It's supposed to make you think, oh, this is, I don't want to see this. I don't want to hear this. I don't want to. So there is an element that we should be willing to accept. That's how nonviolence work. And in every nonviolent movement, I was in the last 18 months somehow in everywhere where there was a conflict and a peace agreement, sometimes not peace agreement, from Rwanda to South Africa to India to Colombia to Vietnam, all over. I managed to Northern Ireland to go to everywhere there was a conflict. And look, nonviolence in any of those places was considered offensive. Desmond Tutu was considered an awful person by Reagan. He called him a person who's promoting conflict and he doesn't care about black people and he kills himself a victim. Desmond Tutu was the most important person making peace agreement in addition to Nelson Mandela happen. He was a legend. But he wasn't, while he was doing that work, loved. Neither was Nelson Mandela. They were provocative in a lot of what they've done and what they've said. So let us also keep that in mind. And in preparing for peace of what Maoz just mentioned, peace doesn't guarantee 100% security. It will never do that. It's impossible. But it will guarantee way more security and safety than what we have today. In Northern Ireland, right after they signed the Good Friday Agreement, they had the biggest terror attack that claimed lives in the whole conflict. The biggest bombing happened right after. And they had a choice. Do we go back to war and killing each other, or do we continue in the path of peace? So part of the preparation that Maoz is talking about is changing our mindset to say, nonviolence doesn't mean no casualties. Peace doesn't mean it will be perfect fully, but it's a choice. And with time, we're changing the mindset, and we will get to that level, but it takes time, and it takes a lot of work, and it takes every generation has to rededicate ourselves to that work.
I want to thank both of you so much for your continued advocacy, for the dreams that you have, for inviting us all in to that prophetic imagination, to dream that there can be true peace for all between the river and the sea. I think when we had a Lonely Green from Omdim Beyachad, from Standing Together, come here, he said, nobody's going anywhere. Palestinians aren't going anywhere. Israeli Jews aren't going anywhere. Nobody's going anywhere. So you have to help us find something together.
Yeah.
Because we're not leaving. Nobody's leaving. And we here in America like to form very secure, ignorant opinions that then we like to shout at one another through various media and social media posts and rooftops. And then we like to other one another and vote one another off the island. And I think at least a first step, if we've learned nothing from any racial justice work we should be doing, is to center the voices that know. So my encouragement to all of us is to continue to center voices like yours, to listen to the wisdom that you bring, and to amplify their voices. Their voices are not choosing sides. They're choosing the side of peace and of hope and of justice for all going forward. So if we don't know what to say online, if we don't know how to have the conversation, if you don't feel like you're an expert in Mideast peace, good job, you're not. I'm not. Let's center the voices that live there, that know, and that do know and can dream for a peace that they both can hold together. Amen?
Amen. Amen.
If you want a mandala, I have many mandalas. Okay, you help yourself.
And
one.
I'll stand out if anybody wants a book. I'll happy to sign it.
Yes, let's make before a couple. Go ahead.
Before we break, I just want to... Earlier we offered the priestly blessing, which was in our tradition first offered by Aaron, the high priest. And Aaron is considered in our tradition one of the great seekers of peace. And in Pirkei Avot, the tradition of our ancestors, it says, be a student of Aaron, who was a lover of peace and a seeker of peace, who loved God, God's creations, and brought them closer to Torah. And Danielle, you can end with this other piece of Pirkei Avot, but I just wanted to remind us of something that I came across this past Shabbat when we were reading about Aaron, who is also the lighter of the menorah, the lighter of the lamps in the ancient temple, in the ancient Mishkan, the tabernacle. And one of the commentaries said that it was hard to keep this eternal light going. It had to stay lit for 7 days. But Aaron made sure that that light was there every single day, day in and day out. And I want to thank the two of you for keeping that light going, that light of possibility, that light of hope, and sharing that light with all of us. And so how do we take that light and keep it burning? Because like Aaron may have kept it going, but he needed a lot of strength and support from the community. And so I also want to invite us to be students, disciples of Aaron, who loved and sought peace. And I invite everyone not to give up hope, to create hope, and to keep doing what we can to support your vision of peace and understanding.
Thank you.
Amen. A lot of us ask after moments like this of what can we do? What is possible? And you mentioned it very well, Aziz. We're going to become storytellers. So whether online, in whatever influence you have, somebody this week will say, how was your weekend? And you'll say, amazing. I was in a room and this amazing thing happened and I got to hear these voices and center this hope and this peace and this joy, even in days like this. Jesus taught on the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers, happy, asherei, are the peacemakers, because they will be called children of God. We are all in this room, children of God, all of us made in the Tzelem Elohim, in the image and likeness of God. And we can't do everything, but we can do something. And so we'll end with this quote from Perkei Avot. Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. You are not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it. Our job today is to go be storytellers of peace. Amen.